Hello and thanks for tuning in. My guest today is Jill Luber, Chief Technology Officer of Elsevier. Well, Jill, thank you very much for joining me today. What is the main benefit of using AI in academic, the kind of work that you that Elsevier does, which I guess is worth just touching on? You're an academic publisher, is that the right term?
Correct. Academic publishing. Yep. So our main use case is to help researchers look through all of our journals and literature and really help their research that they're doing. So for us, AI is really helping the researchers synthesizing vast volumes of data. So all of the literature that we have, looking through the full text, bubbling up concepts and linking together different articles that would normally take a human hours and hours, or maybe even impossible to do. So it's having the ability to really dig through the content, understanding what's there, finding connections, surfacing both existing concepts as well as white space for researchers, because that's really important when it comes to research.
And I was talking to a young journalist a few days ago about how we used to work in the early 90s, rolling back the clock a long, long way. But this is not pre-internet, but this was, or pre-web, sorry, but this was before online news was so accessible. And we used to have to go upstairs, because of the way the office was organized, they only had one Reuters terminal, which you had to sort of share. And we would sit at the Reuters terminal and do the research that we needed to do, and then go down three stories, go back to our desk and say, right, you know, I've printed out all of this stuff. These are the leads that I'm now going to follow up. Pre-AI, how was this work done?
Right. So this is an interesting time for us. So Elsevier is over 145 years old now. So it's a very, very long-standing company. We've had major, really generational changes three times in the course of the company. So the first was the printing press. So that was a major change to how publishing was done. Then the point you made around the internet and having this digital content available to everyone around the world, that was a major change. And now with AI, we're having another inflection point. So pre-AI, in the digital world, we did have very, very strong search algorithms that we could index entire sets of data and we could search. And so these searches were what you're used to with a keyword search. So you type in keywords of concepts of what you're looking for. You would look across all of the literature based on those keywords and then surface the information up. It would normally be a list of hits. Here are all the articles that hit those terms that you asked for. And now the researcher would dig into each of those, dig through the journals, look through, again, so much content. I mean, some of these articles are, 30 pages long, just a single article, right? And so having to do all that research and dig through and find the nuggets of information that's needed took a very long time. Post-AI, what we are able to do is do a lot of that digging for you ahead of time. So one, there's two major improvements. The concept of the search. So being able to search whole concepts and neighboring concepts, in fact, not just keywords. So really understanding the semantic of the question you're asking, understanding the semantic of each of the articles that we have and making the connection. So knowledge graphs are used there. Then the second piece is, again, not just the keywords you're asking, but the whole question, the concept. What are you asking to research? And then looking through each of the articles to find key points, claims. You think of research, there are lots of claims in research. We want to bubble those up, cite them, make sure that we have the provenance. We have exactly who said it, when they said it, right, for what purpose. As well as not all journal articles are as impactful. What's really important in science is reproducibility. So we also have the ability now to look through all this content and find the work, the research that has been reproduced. It's reproducibility, which therefore makes it, there's a higher trust with those articles, with that research, if it's been reproducible versus the research that no one's been able to reproduce since. Doesn't mean it's invalid, but we don't have as much evidence, right? And yes. So having the ability to bubble that up to the researcher so that they can then take the information and then go to the next level of what they want to do in their research with that information. So spending less time digging through pages and pages of journals and then having to come up with, on your own, which of these is reproducible, which is not, trying to bubble that up is really as fast as possible and really increase the speed of research.
Yes. I presumably you've looked at the risks, opportunities. What are the drawbacks of this approach? And I'm thinking aloud here around whether it makes the work of researching more straightforward, and in which case the researchers are not digging in as deep as they should potentially into the subject matter. Well, I know, for example, I look at academic papers on quantum computing. I don't understand all of it. I don't understand any of it, in fact. But I know I can find the papers, and I know I can search on particular things within that paper and find something that I do understand. But I haven't read the paper because, it's just beyond me. The math is too complicated for me.
Right. Well, that's actually one of the advantages, right, of the AI, too, is we are able to bring people who aren't the expert in a field up to speed rather quickly and yes. explaining concepts. But to your point around the drawbacks, so there's a couple just with the nature of an LLM. So LLMs, we know there's hallucination. We know there's bias in the models themselves. So if you're using the model just to ask the question, there is a real risk in one, just again, the hallucinations. But we are seeing some models trained on specific science and health domains. So they're getting better. So they are getting better at answering those questions. But it depends on, right, what's the point of the question? If it's like you said, you just want to learn more about a subject, it's probably okay. That's probably good enough. But if you're a researcher, you're not actually asking a question that can be answered by definition. You're exploring new space. So what you really want is the ability to surface all the different points. So it could be claims that agree with your hypothesis, claims that disagree with your hypothesis. And now it's up to you to decide how you continue your research and how you move forward. I think if you just ask the LLM questions, large language models want to give you an answer. That's what they are trained to give you an answer. And in scientific research, there's not an answer to these questions, right? That's the point of the research. So I think it's just how you use it. And if you're just using it as a black box to answer questions, there are good use cases for that. They just aren't scientific research use cases. I think in the scientific research use case, you really need to use the power of the LLM, but also, again, allowing the researcher, the human, to make that judgment in the end of what they're going to do with the information, right? What the information is useful for them, help them weed out what they can use going forward.
What guardrails are you putting in place? I'm thinking aloud here again, sorry, but just bouncing off some of the things you're saying. And Computer Weekly has written and covered in the past this idea, and I've spoken to a few CTO, CIO, head of data type people, about this idea of the LLM being the judge and the jury. So you have them judging each other's work, marking each other's homework almost, which is a way to avoid hallucinations. Thinking aloud, as I said, I wonder whether that there is a risk that makes the human researcher who's doing this work not be as thorough, potentially, that there is a risk that they take the easy option. I'll ask an LLM to check this other LLM.
Right. We have human in the loop in all of our processes. So any of the products, LeapSpace is our primary AI product in research. And one of the ways we develop LeapSpace and its use of LLMs is having human evaluation. So we evaluate, we take subject matter experts in different domains, and we test out, here are the questions we asked of the product, here are the answers we gave. You as the human now with the domain expert, is it a good answer? Is it accurate? Is it capturing all the information it should? Does it do harm? That's an important piece of our evaluation, is could this answer actually do harm? And we use that human evaluation to continue to help tweak the use of the LLMs and of the product. I think that's an important piece of keeping the human in the loop. We do the same with, because I do run a technology organization, so we're building code. And your point about using LLMs as judge and jury and reviewer, we are using LLMs to write code. We're using LLMs to check code. But before anything goes to production, we have human review. So what we've done is we have taken a burden off of the humans and the time it takes to write code, but they are still reviewing the code. It doesn't matter, like checking the homework and like the point you're making about using different LLMs. At the end of the day, they can still make mistakes, and we still have to have that human quality check. And it's really difficult, and asking the LLMs are surfacing really difficult questions to the human as opposed to the more mundane questions, which is exactly right. That's what we want. We want those like more thoughtful reasoning domain expert questions to come to the humans for the answer, as opposed to automating that piece. There's a lot we can automate. Then there's a lot we should automate that is the lower risk, again, more of that mundane work that the LLMs can do for us, which is amazing. And we have had, you know, amazing progress as a result. But it's really highlighting the value of the human in the loop is what we've found. And so that's the way we, in the product development, we surface the information to the researcher in a way that's, again, not necessarily answering the question, this is the answer, you can be lazy about it, but these are the claims, here's the data to back it up. You're welcome to dig in further or explore a different area. And hopefully it encourages that next level of thought as opposed to the, I'm just going to trust the LLM and move on.
I imagine that we have a learning curve to go through, all of us as society, as the human race, as AI starts becoming part of education, part of research, part of the day-to-day life of everyone. I mean, you were just talking about coding, and I think, you know, that the technology sector, I mean, I've written a feature, I wrote and researched a feature on network managers. You know, you don't have Cisco certified engineers anymore, or you do, but that's not as considered the kind of job that, you know, we were talking about what happened in the 90s when you know, the internet web was just starting to appear, and you know, things like that sort of job ad would be a really hot skill. It's a skill, definitely, but it isn't a skill as important today, because the technology has advanced so much that you don't need to be that level of engineer to manage a network.
Right.
And AI, large language models, will make that easier, just as it is making coding easier.
It does make it easier, but what it's also surfacing, I'm finding, is new needs for my technology, the engineers. And, you know, there's this new concept of AI engineer emerging. And what we're finding is that these tools, the ones that specifically allow, we'll call it vibe coding. So no technical background needed in order to create a new, you know, I mean, dashboards, web pages, applications. There's lots, and we're encouraging it in the organization, but what we're finding is you can only get so far, and then you're going to need the intervention of the technology team to harden some of these processes and dashboards and things that, so let's take an example, like my finance team have lots of reports they create on an ongoing basis. With the tools, they can themselves create a new automated agent workflow that can create these reports for them. However, they really need that agent to be in a more productionized environment so that it's safe, it's secure, it has the right access, it's up and running, we understand the cost. That's when you really need an engineer to intervene and help bring it up to that production level quality. So there's still a need there. And in fact, that's a new need. I've never had software engineers dedicated to the finance function before. Right? So this is a new need for my team to support some of these areas that are taking advantage of AI and making their jobs better. But they still need our support to do that. And so I think there's, yes, you're seeing shifts in what, how many engineers you need, but I'm finding that you need them in new places you didn't before. I think what's really cool about the AI right now is there are more functions and more areas of a business that are learning you can do more with code. Code is actually really cool and it helps me do my job better. Yeah. Even if you don't know how to write the code, you can still create, with AI, you can create the processes to use it.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And just finally, you were in London recently. So tell me about that. Why were you in London?
I was in London presenting at the London Book Fair. I was in the publisher's corner and I had a presentation. It was a lot of, it was exciting and scary. It was both. So if you imagine I'm in a room with both my customers, my competitors, right, users, it's the whole community. And there was a moment that I appreciated having the opportunity to talk about what AI is bringing to the publishing world, and then really concentrate on the responsibility that I think we as publishers have around protecting the quality, the provenance, and right, just in publishing and science. We still have a real responsibility to some of the things we already touched on around being lazy with AI. We've got to protect the academic publishing world from the AI slop that can come in. Now that it is easier to create, right? An AI can create a 30-page research paper for you out of thin air on fake science. And it is our job to protect the publishing world from that. It is very worrying. And we've seen a major increase in this fabricated science, if you will. And so there's so the same tools that create it are the same tools that can help us spot it and stop it. And so that is another use case that we have with AI to help find and stop this, you know, fake publications, fake articles before they get into our journals, because it has real world implications, right? So creating and publishing science that's not real clearly has implications as people start to, because there's a level of trust with what you read in scientific journals. And if we start to erode that trust, I think that's when we're in real trouble.
You don't have to answer this one, but were there any surprising questions you got from your presentation?
The questions I got were around, because I talked a lot about making sure we have this trusted system. And so just questions about dig a little bit more into what trusted system is. And because I think what the question was really about is there ever a day when we get rid of peer review? And my answer is no, we are not going to get rid of the peer review. I think that again, I talked about human in the loop. Peer reviewed journals is the original human in the loop. Mm-hmm. We've had that process for a very long time. And it is reaching out to the domain experts and asking to just, there's, before it was about, is this novel science? Is it new? Is it interesting? Is it worth spending time for the reader? Now we're asking them, the next level, like, is there a chance this is non-repeatable and fake science and fake data and really help us prevent that? And so I think there's actually going to be more, not less, on the peer review in publishing. And so that was one of the questions that came up is like, do we feel like there'll be a time where we can, because speed to publication is so important. If you can cut out that peer review, you can go a lot faster. But at the risk of quality. And that's not a risk that we're willing to take. And it's, it was kind of my plea to all of the publishing publishers in the room, is that this is not a shortcut we can take.
No, okay. Well, Jill, thank you ever so much for taking part in the podcast today. You can find the podcast on iTunes and on Amazon Music and read the full article on www.computerweekly.com.